Hello and welcome to the Rhizone podcast. I'm your host, William Clausen. Here's my conversation with Peter Van Wiel. Peter is an engineer, a mechanical engineer, a professor, and a founder of a plant growth system called Plant Empowerment. Plant Empowerment not only challenges the status quo in conventional growing methods, but also boasts a massive increase in production with little or no grower training. If this piques your interest, following is my conversation with Peter. So hello, Peter. Thanks for joining us today. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, William. And hello to all the listeners, the viewers today. Thank you for inviting me to tell something about plant empowerment.
Absolutely. So what is plant empowerment? Just in a nutshell, I know I'm going to probably ask you a lot of questions about it, but what should I know about plant empowerment just to kind of introduce me to it?
Yeah, it's a method described in a 380 pages book. So it's quite complicated. But the idea is that we listen to the plant. Growers use their feeling of comfort to decide how they create a specific climate in their greenhouse. We hate that. I'm a mechanical engineer. I like to use sensors and models, etc. So what we do is we measure the behavior of the plant, and the basis for that is the stomata opening. We discovered that in 2008, how to do that. And we figured out that stomata are the only way plants can react on the climate that they are offered. So why don't we look at the opening status of the stomata and try to, well, make it as comfortable as possible for the plant to use all the CO2 available and the water, etc. That's basically plant empowerment.
Okay, so basically when we're talking about this being a different way of growing, you call the traditional method like an experience-based growing, I think, or traditional growing.
Yeah.
It's more about how can I create the best environment based on all the experience and knowledge I know? And with plant empowerment, what you're saying is you said you look at the stomata, which is like, what is the stomata? Just, I know a lot of our listeners will know, but just help me explain it.
Okay.
Help me understand as well.
Stomata are the very small openings in a leaf of a plant that are able to release water to cool the plant, to bring the temperature of the tissue down. Water is a very good cooling system. And on the other hand, through the same opening, it absorbs CO2, and that's, well, really the food of the plant. Sometimes it's kind of confusing that we are talking about nutrients absorbed by the roots, but the real food for plants is CO2. And the stomata allow the plant to absorb the CO2. And the idea is that the higher the concentration of CO2 in the air, and the more the stomata, the wider the stomata are open, the better production of sugars you have, and the plants need sugar to grow. So stomata opening for us is very essential to obtain a very high production, but also to get a very resilient plant, because if it's able to convert light into sugars, it also becomes very healthy.
So a current traditional growing method where we're controlling the environment as much as we can, keep humidity down or up based on the plant cycles and stuff, we traditionally don't look at that?
We don't look at it at all. Actually, we are teasing the plant all the time when we control climate in a traditional way, because, like I said, the stomata are transpiring water. But if the water available in the tissue is not enough, it has to close its stomata a little bit to reduce the transpiration. But by reducing the transpiration, it's also more difficult to get the CO2 in. So if you want to grow plants, which is, well, the target of a grower, then you better make sure that it can absorb as much CO2 as possible without losing too much water. Now, what many growers do is they control their climate in the greenhouse based on the temperature of the air in the greenhouse as well as on the relative humidity in the greenhouse. And it's all based on their own feeling of comfort. When they feel it's getting too hot and too humid and you don't feel comfortable as a human being, many people suppose that the plant will experience it exactly in the same way. But that's not true. That's why I have this tropical forest behind me in this picture. This is a very hot and humid climate, and this is where you find the highest productions of plants.
So the concept. So would you say that the traditional method is not taking into account any of the factors that the plant would like? Because we know that to propagate something, it's typically a much more humid environment. But then when the plants are older, they don't need that. So are we not then somewhat doing that already?
If you propagate, you try to reduce transpiration of the plant as much as possible to make sure that it doesn't dry out, and it uses all of its energy to produce roots and tissue. Now, we found out about 20 years ago that even if you propagate, stomata play a very important role, which means that even if you grow under a very high relative humidity, you should have very high light levels in your propagation room, and combine this with very high CO2 levels. And if you do this, then you get twice the amount of growth in a specific period of time compared to the traditional way. And that will give you very strong and healthy plants. And when you have a very good start, it's like a baby, then you will also grow as an adult much stronger.
So you're saying two times as much growth, that's evidential, like you have empirical evidence?
Yeah, exactly.
So, just in a layman's terms, what we have to think of, these stomatas are not just like pores like we have on our skin that sweat. It's also a method of taking nutrients in. So if we close them, we may sweat less, but we're actually also stifling our nutrient intake.
Yeah, exactly. And we feel, as a plant empowerment team, that we should try to keep the stomata as open as possible, because it's quite expensive to maintain a very high CO2 level in the greenhouse, especially if you try to reduce the temperature in the greenhouse by ventilation. Now, the amount of CO2 absorbed by the tissue depends on the concentration difference on both sides of the stomata opening. So if you keep the stomata very wide open, you can do with a lower CO2 concentration in the greenhouse air and still have the same absorption rate.
Because it's taking more in, so therefore the higher concentration.
Entrance is bigger opening, yes.
So do current methodologies are trying to increase the concentration of CO2 and therefore because the plant is having trouble taking it in. So you say, well, just open the intake and then you don't need as high concentration.
Yeah. And the trick to do this is to keep the relative humidity in the greenhouse relatively high, because that will push the transpiration rate a little bit down. That means that the plant can keep its stomata open for a longer period of time, because the root system is simply not able to supply enough water according to the rate of transpiration. The plant stores some water, but usually if you have a very high transpiration during the morning under high light levels, then at noon the water supply of the root system will not be able to keep the high transpiration level high enough. Then the stomata will close, and then we have a reduction of growth. We call that the afternoon depression. And the idea is that if you keep the relative humidity in the greenhouse at a higher level, especially in the morning, so you reduce transpiration in the morning, you will have a longer water available in the plant for the entire day. And on an average, you have more opening of the stomata, and you have more production. But many growers hesitate to do this because if you want to keep the relative humidity in the greenhouse high, and I mean really high in terms of between 80 and 90% relative humidity, then you have to reduce your window opening. Else you will lose all the water to the outside world. Now, growers are afraid that under high light conditions, the temperature in the greenhouse of the air will rise very quickly. But that's not true because the plants, as long as they are transpiring, are also cooling the greenhouse. Look at an empty greenhouse without plants, it will get terribly hot, but as soon as you introduce plants, they will cool the greenhouse. The leaves are...
Plants are not only cooling themselves, they become a cooling system for the greenhouse and the air around them as well.
The leaves are much colder than the greenhouse air, so they cool down the greenhouse air. So you don't need to be that much afraid of what's happening. The other thing is that if you are able to produce a lot of sugars by keeping the stomatas open and have a lot of CO2 coming in, then you need to have a higher leaf temperature on an average over the day to convert those sugars into growth, because it's a sort of gamma cofactory, conversion of sugars into plant cells, and you need temperature, energy to do that. So if you have more sugar production during the day, you need to have a higher tissue temperature over the entire day. And that means you can easily accept warmer greenhouse temperatures without a problem, as long as you were able to keep the stomata open. And this is the trick that a company like BASF has done with our assistance. They were able to produce 120 kilogram tomatoes in a year, a square meter, and that's about 40% more than they were used to. And this is, well, the big, that's consistent. Yeah, it's even higher now. So, and I have asked my colleagues, the professors at Rutgers University in Arizona, to test the same principle in the middle of the desert of Arizona, and they got the same result. And up to now, it was quite complicated to grow a tomato crop in summertime in the desert, because the crop was, well, getting smaller and smaller, short leaf length and small fruits, etc. But when you increase the humidity by reducing window opening and you keep the relative humidity high in the greenhouse, and you introduce the CO2, which is cost effective because you don't have a lot of ventilation, then you can easily grow a very good crop, even in the middle of the summer. And that's what this was done by a master student, and he sort of validated the plant empowerment method for this environment. And I was very happy to see this.
Absolutely. It sounds to me like as you're explaining that, and I think you even mentioned it a couple of times, that there's several pieces there that are very counterintuitive to the traditional method of growing. So
exactly.
How do you balance that? Or like what's in it for a grower? Because there seems to be a lot of leaps of faith. Yeah, as you explain it, the biology makes sense, but yet it doesn't seem like it's traditional. So what's in it for a grower to do this?
Yeah, it's like what a Canadian grower said, you cannot be a little bit pregnant. And it means that you have to forget all the old traditional ideas about how to grow a plant. You really have to trust your senses. And what we do is even more challenging, because we make a feed forward system instead of a feed backward control system. The typical grower goes into his greenhouse every evening, looks at his plants, the color of his stems or the top of his plants or whatever, and then he decides whether he has done it in the right way the day before. And then it changes the climate the next day. We don't do that. We make a plan for an entire crop, so for tomato crop for an entire year. And we stick to that. We say you have a specific amount of light available during a year, if you have sunlight only, you know, based on tradition, how much light you can expect. And if you have artificial lights, you have some more control. But that's your light plan for an entire year. So you know how many moles per day you can give to the plant. And sometimes we even take away some moles to stick to the plant. And then we also make a plan for plant density. We call plant balance, plant load, over the entire crop. So we change the number of stems per square meter according to the amount of available light. And we do that in advance and we stick to that. We don't change the plan, we stick to that. And that it's important to do that to keep the plants in balance, because it takes time to convert the sugars into growth. And this affects the next day and the day after. And you should not change that too often. So we say, keep your fingers from your computer control. Don't change your set points all the time. Just decide before you start a crop how to do it. And then the only thing we do is check every day whether we have been able to make a specific combination of light sum and temperature sum. And with temperature sum, I mean temperature of the tissue, not of the air, because the plant doesn't even know the air temperature. It knows its tissue temperature, its leaf temperature, for instance, is very important. And if we have received a specific amount of light during the day, we adjust the average temperature sum for that day according to that light sum. And since we know what we can expect, we can make that plan in advance.
So, and your goal is not to be changing that. Your goal is to just try to achieve that every day and then be measuring yourself against how are you achieving, not what does my plant look like.
Yeah. And if of course, light is the most difficult to control. You can have dark days. And then what you do is to adjust the average day temperature.
So not just, oh, it's dark, so light up the lights. It's an average that you're looking for.
Now, when I say day temperature, again, I need to say that it is average tissue temperature. And controlling the air temperature is one way to do that. But we also know, and that's what we have found out the last 10 years intensively, is that the plant is, the leaves are losing energy to the sky by radiation. We call that heat emission. If the roof of the greenhouse or the screen, if you have pulled this, close the screen, if that has a lower temperature than the plant tissue, the plant will lose energy to its environment. And then it will drop in temperature, and it can drop below the air temperature, below the surrounding air temperature. And that means that there's a risk of dropping below dew point, especially if you maintain a high relative humidity like I want to do. Then dew point is very near the actual air temperature, or the actual tissue temperature in this case. Now, what we try to do is to control the temperature of the screen. Now it's getting a little bit complicated, but we measure the screen temperature. That's something.
And the screen being the curtain or the light blocker kind of.
Curtain, yes.
Yeah.
The curtain, the whether it's an energy screen or a darkling blackout screen or whatever. Because this is what this is the ceiling that the plant is seeing. It's covered by the screen. And so we need to control and change the rise exactly at the screen temperature to make sure that the plant does not lose so much energy to to the sky. And we do that by taking two screens. So you get a sort of air layer between the two curtains, as you said, which is acting as an insulation. And the still air is acting as an insulator, making the lower screen warmer. And if the screen is still too cold, and that can happen when it's very cold outside, like I was in Toronto 2 weeks ago, and they told me, well, it can be minus 20 here, and then it's getting very cold above the screens, so then the screens will also get very cold. What do you do then? Well, then you need to keep the upper screen closed. It should be an airtight screen, so there's no cold air dropping through the screen. And you pull a small screen gap in the lower screen to make warm air escape between the two screens. And by measuring the screen temperature, we can exactly measure how much energy, or how much air we have to introduce between the two screens to make the screen warmer, warm enough to keep the plants warm.
So you're comparing that environment. So you're not necessarily looking at the air temperature, you're looking at the screen temperatures, which will then influence it, of course. But so is there like a framework that certain plants will need certain temperatures, or are you just comparing the tissue temperature to the environment temperature, I guess, or the screen temperature and things like that? Or how do you know a tomato plant is going to have its best transpiration at a certain temperature versus a strawberry plant or something? Like, is there a framework or something that you work off of?
Okay, now you're talking about two different things. First thing is tissue temperature determining the conversion of sugars. So that's growth. That's one thing we want to control. The other reason to control tissue temperature is because of fungal diseases. Once the tissue gets below dew points, water will condensate on the leaves, and then you get either botrytis or flower rot or whatever. And in the past, growers were always trying to control the climate to prevent the fungal diseases. We don't do that. Yeah. We measure the leaf temperature, and we measure the air temperature surrounding the leaf. So we are taking a different measurement compared to a computer control box, because a computer control box is measuring the air above the plants, but we need to measure the air inside the canopy. We measure the temperature and the relative humidity of that air, because this determines the chance for condensation. The water is produced by the leaves, so you can expect the highest humidities directly surrounding the leaves at 1 millimeter distance away from it. So there you have the biggest chances of condensation. And the computer control box doesn't tell you that risk. This happened, for instance, this winter. Many growers have changed to LED, moving away from HPS to LED, and all of a sudden, many of them had botrytis. And they did not understand why, because the only thing that changed was the artificial light. Same light level. But since the LEDs produce the same amount of bar light, which means you have the same amount of evaporation of the plants, so the moisture rising between the canopy is still the same. But since the LEDs don't produce infrared, the air between the leaves is colder than you used to have in the past. And then you get condensation and botrytis. So we needed a different approach for this. And, well, growers said, well, let's put up a warmer pipe and then we solve the problem. I don't do that, because that's a waste of energy. There's two things. First of all, you increase the transpiration again, which is making your problem worse. and you can hope that the air temperature inside the canopy rises enough to stay away from condensation, but it's not very certain. It's much better to keep the tissue warmer by working in a better way with your screens, like I said, putting a sort of warm blanket above your screens to prevent heat emission, which means that the leaves do not drop in temperature below air temperature. And the second thing you need to do is to introduce air movement inside the canopy to drive the moisture out of the canopy. Since we are all trying to save energy, reduce energy consumption of the greenhouse, we close screens, but that means that the heating pipes are getting a much lower temperature than we were used to in the past. And that means there's hardly any air movement produced by hot pipes. So you really have to make sure that you create air movement yourself within the canopy with a fan. And I think that's a very intelligent way to do this, because to drive the moisture out of the canopy with a fan takes about 1 watt per square meter. And if you want to do this exactly the same with a hot pipe, it's about 30 watts per square meter. So that's much more energy. And well, we have proven that this is really solving the problem.
So how are you finding, like, again, there's a lot of counterintuitive pieces. And so how do you go about taking this to a grower? Like I know you mentioned one of your growers said you can't be, you know, somewhat pregnant. You either are or you aren't. So you can't just somewhat do plant empowerment because there are so many variables that are affecting it. So are there some steps you can take, or, yes, or what is the transition to this? If a grower says, I really like that idea, this makes a lot of sense, but what do I do now?
Well, the best result is if you take a young student from the university or from high school and teach him plant empowerment, so he has no growing tradition at all, and he can do the trick, right? All the way with all the sensors that we need, he can do it within a week, and we've proven that. That's why we are using the plant empowerment book nowadays as the standard at our schools and universities. Actually, the same thing is happening in Ontario at the moment. Niagara College is also using our book as standard. So this is the real future, because they don't make the mistakes. But if you have a lot of experience, like many growers in Holland who think they are the best of the world sometimes, I hesitate to say this, but it's not true, because they are having a lot of problems to make this conversion. And for those, we have a list of steps. We say, okay, what you need to do is to buy a sensor that measures the temperature and relative humidity inside the canopy. It's a very cheap sensor. Inside the canopy, they already have their computer control sensor, so start comparing that, and you will notice that there's a huge difference between those two measurements. Actually, that's what I did with the LED problem. I did not introduce a lot of new strategies. I just started to measure. We did it together, looked at the data after 1 day, and we could take the right conclusions. And then the growers saw that it was far too humid inside the canopy. And then they started asking, what can we do to prevent this? Well, then you have all kinds of methods that are the next steps. But the first thing is just to understand what's happening in your crop.
And so that's just for them to see what the program is seeing. So plant empowerment is looking at a different set of variables or a different concept. So let's just start by looking at it and then start comparing what you know and what you don't know, and then start building from there.
And then the next step is to collect data about how you have done it in the past. Like I said, the ratio between amount of moles during a day and the average day temperature. And if you don't have a tissue temperature sensor, not a leaf temperature sensor. Okay, start with the air temperature because you have that in your computer already, and make a what we call a cloud of data, a graph that shows you for every single day of your crop what was the relation between those two. You get a cloud of data. And well, then you will notice that there were days that you have little light and high temperatures, or little light and low temperatures, or in summer a lot of light and low temperatures, or a lot of light and high temperatures. What we asked to do then, and the computer can do that for you, is to draw an average line between all those dots, because this seems to be the way you want to grow. You strive to have a certain relation between light and temperature. Okay, let's try to use that line as a starting point for your next crop.
So it's very contextual, because you're in Arizona, that's going to be very different than if you're in northern Canada. So you're already building that data cloud, if you will, of
based
context.
On your own data. Yeah. So we don't ask you to grow in a very different way. It's just an imitation of what you already did, but without less fluctuation. That's the idea. Do that in the next crop, and then try to stay away from the set points, which is a very... But, okay, read the book, the set points for temperature and relative humidity. And then, if you are used to this, and it takes some time, then we ask you to try to think about, does the plant really need a specific vapor deficit in the greenhouse air, or does it need a specific transpiration rate? I'm sure that it is the last thing, but nobody controls its climate based on transpiration rate. But that's actually what you need to do to keep your stomata as wide open as possible. You have to limit the transpiration on hot summer days to make sure that you can keep your windows closed, keep your CO2 in your greenhouse, and get the best production. On the other hand, in a dull, dark winter day, don't waste energy on keeping the greenhouse too warm, because the plants will only stretch but don't get more production. So I think those are the steps that the beginner should take. And well, each step requires a different amount of sensors. Like I said, you start with a sensor measuring the temperature and relative humidity inside the canopy. It's a very cheap sensor. The next step is to start measuring the plant temperature. And the best thing to do this is with a thermal camera. They're very affordable nowadays. For $400, you can buy a thermal camera that's good enough to do what you want to do, just to see how your tissue reacts on what you're doing in combination with the air temperature and relative humidity inside the tissue. Based on those two sensors, you can already use a formula that can help you to calculate the transpiration rate. The only additional sensor that you need is to measure the amount of energy absorbed by the leaf. Now, perlite is something that everybody knows. It's a sort of radiation. It's a source of energy to the plant. And then we also, many of you also know that we also have the infrared, which is also a source of energy. Now, you can buy a sensor that measures the total amount of energy coming down to the plant. And the same sensor is also measuring the plant, the amount of energy, amount of radiation that is reflected by the plant, because not all the energy coming down is absorbed by the plant, because if that was true, you could not see your plants. So perlite is partly reflected, and the same is true for infrared. And for the plant, only the amount of energy absorbed by the leaf is important. So you have to measure that. Now, if you know that, then you can do many things. You can calculate the transpiration rate, which I think is something we should control to get the best, the highest productions, and also to prevent fungal diseases. Stay away, far away from that. You can also use the same equipment to calculate the stomata opening. And like I started to say, is the best thing we can achieve is to keep the stomata as wide open as possible, because then we use all the resources in the best way we can think of.
So is there a certain amount of energy that you know a plant needs, or is it again?
Yeah, it eats about 1.2% of the energy.
So there is a framework there of roughly.
Yeah, but it's so small that we don't take it into account. This is the energy needed to convert CO2 into plant cells. But it's very small. Plant is not a very efficient thing to convert solar energy, actually. The idea is that once you, again, see how the plant reacts on high radiation, for instance, or low relative humidity in your greenhouse or whatever, then you can start thinking about what can I do to improve this. And then you are really on the path of, well, using plant empowerment to what it's meant for. But it takes, I think, 2 or 3 years to get there.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So because you talked about maybe doing some crops and stuff. So about 2 to 3 years, starting from, okay, I'm skeptical, I want to, and then you introduce sensors, you get people to see what they see, and then people start asking questions, and that's when, you know, they're ready to learn. So you're saying that's about a 2 to 3 year process. So what's the entire process in, if I'm a skeptical grower who's always done it and had great productions, but I'd like to try this, the total process is 3 to 5 years to get plant empowerment embedded into our system?
No, I think you can do it in 3 years. But you need assistance to do that, because a grower has a lot of things to do. You cannot keep concentrating on that. So I would say the best thing is to hire a student who knows about plant empowerment. And they are available nowadays. So that's one of the benefits of plant empowerment. It doesn't take many years like it did in the past to train a grower. You can do it in a couple of months. Even somebody who has never been in a greenhouse is able to grow a crop. We actually proved that. We had a competition in the Netherlands at the university where I worked, the Wageningen University, to grow a crop out of an office. So we had six crops in the greenhouse, and we were sitting in an office. I did not do that, but some people who had never grown a crop before were controlling the climate in the greenhouse. And you know what? They have beaten a team of the best growers of the Netherlands. They were allowed to come in the greenhouse and do anything they could to have the highest production as possible and lowest inputs of energy and whatever. But we've beaten them. We had the highest production, the lowest amount of energy, the lowest amount of CO2 and fertilizer and water. So that's why we say it's a sustainable system, and it's available for every uneducated person. All you need to know is the methods and how to use the sensors. Now, the biggest challenge for most experienced growers is the use of the screens, because we try to convince them to close the curtains more often and keep them tightly closed. No screen gaps. Screen gaps are terrible because they ruin the horizontal temperature uniformity in the greenhouse, because the greenhouses are so big nowadays that on one end of the greenhouse, warm air will escape through the screen gaps, and on the other end of this greenhouse, cold air will drop vertically down, creating 5 to 6 degrees centigrade lower temperature at that local location. And if you want to control something, uniformity is the key thing. That's another thing I always tell. Start improving your uniformity before you even try to use plant empowerment. Okay, it's described in the book how to do that. That time is too short to do that. But keeping the screens closed, especially two screens closed, is the best way to do that.
So a lot of growers would really resist that because they're used to keeping them open or using them all the time. And you're saying, no, you need to keep them closed.
From the past that keeping screens closed is bringing all kinds of fungal problems. And that's true because we did not understand in the past what was creating the fungal problems. Nowadays, we know that air movement and removing the air, the moisture out of the greenhouse are very essential. And we have equipment nowadays to really do that in a much better way than 10 years ago. If you don't do that, if you're not willing to do that, forget about it. Keep using the traditional way because it won't work. Then you run into...
So it has to work. Yeah, it has to work together as a complete system.
If you open screen gaps, you will create a cold air dropping in your canopy, which lowers the tissue temperature below air temperature, and then you get condensation. I'm sorry. And then you run into problems. That's why everybody's trying to fight fungal problems. We never have fungal problems.
I was going to ask that question. What is the impact of this entire system on fungal problems, on bacteria? Like, is there a positive impact? You're talking about not introducing it, but how does it...
It's not existing anymore.
So fungal problems are virtually non-existent.
This method was introduced in the Netherlands about 12 years ago because the Dutch government wanted the growers to reduce energy consumption, but nobody was interested in energy reduction because they had their total energy systems combined heat and power. They tried to use the system and then they found out that their fungal problems were reduced very much by using our strategy. I think it's free gain just by doing
it. So you're creating a better environment for the plant, which is actually creating a worse environment for the funguses and therefore you're it's a win-win on both sides.
But again, you need to make sure that you have a lot of air movement inside your canopy and you get rid of your moisture out of the greenhouse, either by enough ventilation or by buying a dehumidification machine, dry gear or whatever.
To go back to your competition question, you said you had a team of people sitting in an office looking at sensors, controlling them, not entering the greenhouse. And they beat out, had better productions, had better plant health and all that than the team that would every day go in and based on traditional experience-based growing. How does that translate into, I imagine me saying that raises a lot of skepticism and I'm sure you get that all the time. So I have two questions. One is everybody, a lot of problems that happen nowadays is because, I didn't look at my plants. They dried out. I wasn't walking through my crops. I couldn't feel my plants. What do you say to a grower when they say that?
Use the sensors that I described. Look at the right data.
So you're not saying don't enter it. You just use the competition as a proof that you can do it that way. But by all means, keep walking through your plants, but learn to trust these new sensors looking at different data rather than the traditional sensors. And so you're basically changing the inputs into your body so you now start feeling different things.
Exactly. And then after a while, I hope you feel comfortable enough to take the next step. And I know there's a lot of opposition against the idea to use light abatement screens in Ontario. It's because, the society wants that. We have seen this exactly the same in the Netherlands. Growers were against it. They said it's going to be a disaster and whatever. But if you are using our principles, I can guarantee that you won't have problems that people are fearing. Actually, you get even better results because when you close the screens and they are reflecting light, so you get more light in your greenhouse. So you have more benefit of your expensive artificial light and you create a better climate. But it will only work for you if you look at the reaction of the plants and take that into account. Look at the right combination of light sum and temperature sum and prevent condensation.
So how long have you been doing this? And so you said it started about 10, 12 years ago in the Netherlands. And how long have you been doing this in America or in the Americas and Canada? I think you said you're also doing some stuff in South America, if I'm not mistaken. How long have you been gaining some traction?
I started to do this in when the cannabis was legalized in British Columbia. And then the growers wanted to convert from tomatoes to cannabis, but they did not know how to grow it. And one of them asked me, can you tell me, can I use the plant empowerment method to learn as fast as possible how to grow cannabis in a greenhouse? I said, yes, of course, it's a plant. I don't care what the name is.
And in theory, you can grow from behind your desk, so you should be able to grow it not knowing it.
And the nice coincidence was that this was a young grower, and he said, our book was published in that year, and he was the first to read our book. Actually, our book was written in English originally. We had to translate it into Dutch later, so we were really focusing on that market. And he read the book within a couple of days. I couldn't do that. It's really tough to read it in a couple of days, but he did. And he said, you know what? All the things that I've read were always on my mind, but I did not dare to tell my colleagues to do it like that because they would laugh at me. And he said, well, now I'm responsible to grow a decent cannabis crop and I'm going to use this method. So we put a lot of sensors in his greenhouse and I assisted them for a couple of years and they grew a fantastic crop. They're actually expanding and most of their colleagues are out of business already.
So they're actually expanding today when many of the cannabis growers have reverted or gone away, gone broke.
Because their colleagues made the mistake that they were listening to growers who have been growing inside, and they said you have to keep the relative humidity in the greenhouse below 60% all the time to prevent botrytis. And I told this grower, well, good luck. It's not going to work in the greenhouse. It's impossible because you will have a very high transpiration rate unless you take all the light out, but you don't want that. You don't want to buy a greenhouse for that. So we tried to find out, is it really true that the botrytis is caused by a high humidity? And we found out it's not true. Their sensors have proven that the problem is caused by root pressure, which is very high in a very warm crop like cannabis. They allow all the light to come in. And so you have 20 degrees centigrade in the greenhouse and the roots will become very warm. And if you drop the temperature in the evening because you close your blackout screen, then the temperature will drop very quickly, and then the transpiration of the canopy will drop very quickly, but the roots keep pushing. So the roots will push water out of the veins inside the flower. So there's actually water inside the flower, and it stays there because there's no air movement there. And then it starts rotting, to tell it simple. And a couple of days later, you see botrytis on the outside of the flower, but that was not because of the climate outside the flower. It was inside.
So the way we're growing the plant, we actually created the plant to pressure itself into producing moisture that then created that allowed the botrytis to flourish, rather than it being external humidity.
And now you know why I try to convince people to control transpiration rate, because the solution is to keep transpiration going even in the dark.
So how did you get, so that's the story of how you started here in Canada with that. How did, and you also shared with, in the Netherlands, there was this, you know, big energy consumption concept. The government was really pushing a lot of that. How did this journey start for you? Like, where did these ideas come from? What was the beginning of this journey, and how did you land on this?
The beginning of plant empowerment itself, you mean? Yes,
as a concept, because you're going, some of it's counterintuitive. So clearly, somebody must have said, "Hey, maybe we're doing something wrong," or was it an accident, or how did it start?
In the year 2000, approximately, growers in the Netherlands were interested in the closed greenhouse. They wanted to have no ventilation at all, and use all kind of equipment to control the temperature and the humidity in the greenhouse. And the idea was to be able to maintain a very high CO2 level to get the highest production as possible. But they were very surprised. They introduced a lot of air movement in the greenhouse. They installed air tubes, air ducts below the canopy, below the tomato plants in this case. But they were very surprised that the tomatoes were not producing more tomatoes, and the transpiration was going down instead of going up. Everybody that I asked would say, if you introduce a lot of air in the greenhouse surrounding the plants, you will increase transpiration. It's not true. The opposite is true. And so we tried to figure out, what is the physics that will explain this? And the physics is called the energy balance. A guy like Einstein started this long ago. He said, you can never lose energy. Every joule of air, you cannot destroy it. Every joule of energy absorbed by a leaf will leave it, but in a different way. Now, if at that time everybody was thinking that evaporation of the crop was the only way for a leaf to convert its energy. And we found out by reasonable thinking, I'm a mechanical engineer and my colleague is a physicist, so we decided it must be different. And then we found out that a leaf can exchange a lot of energy just by temperature difference between the leaf and its surrounding air, because you have a very huge area of leaf. Every square meter of greenhouse has about 3 square meters of leaf area, and both sides of the leaves can be taken into account, which means you have 6 square meters per square meter greenhouse exchanging energy. And this was a sort of forgotten energy exchange. And well, we figured out that this could explain why stomata are reacting in a different way than people were thinking. And that made us interested in, can we actually measure stomata opening? And we started to do this in 2006. And we started where everybody would start, buy a microscope and look at it. Well, if you want to get nervous, start to do this, because every leaf has thousands of stomata, and you cannot even see the difference between are they not open or a little bit open. So we gave up. And we were kind of, we wanted to win this battle. And then we started to use physics to explain what was happening. And we published this in 2008 at the International Congress, ISHS, International Society for Horticultural Science. And that was really the beginning of our work, when we were able to explain and measure stomata opening. Then you can do all the other things that I've been speaking about. And that what we started to do then, by all kinds of sensors, to find out how can we control the stomach opening. And we asked colleagues and other scientists to validate our methods. And that's what they did. It took 10 years before that was happening, but okay, it has been done in 2018. So now we know that it's really a valuable method, and it's a very simple method that I can explain to everybody. And you need only four sensors to work with it, so it's easy. And that gave us the confidence that we could convince growers to do it like we do it.
So it's it might be a complex thing to wrap our head around in terms of, because we're so, you know, rooted in the traditional way of growing, that might be the most complex piece, the actual science. Once you've, you know, overcome all those challenges, it sounds logical and like you said, it's simple.
When I started my career in 1976, so very long ago, I developed the concrete floor with ebb and flood system, and everybody told me plants will not grow on that kind of floor. It's so different from what we are used. It cannot be a good system. And I said, well, can you tell me why? And they told me that, well, it would get too warm and the plants would get too wet, the soil would get too wet and whatever. And, well, I'm not so sure about this. Why don't we try it? And I was lucky to have a colleague who said, I want to become a grower. I will build 1,000 square meters of this system and test it. And he was so successful with this that within 3 years, there were 300 hectares of concrete floors in the Netherlands. And from that day, I have decided that I want to be very different. I want to have a very different opinion from what growers try to make me believe. I want to see the proofs, and physics are the only proof that I believe in.
So you have some experience challenging the status quo, and
very much.
You know, that very first experience cemented, no, don't mind the pun, to concrete, but that you said, you know what, I need to just believe what I believe, and then have the evidence of physics to back it up, and then go for it. So this is just another round of, I don't believe a concrete floor can do that. And today many people have, you know, flood floors. And this is another round of the same type of thinking. Persistence pays off.
Exactly. And I love to think in systems. You're right. You cannot try to improve one specific thing, because all the other things will change together with it, and the end result will be disappointing. So you really have to understand the entire system and, well, change all the things at the same time.
Obviously, it makes it a little more complex because you have to understand the whole system then too, right? So the time to get there may be a little longer, but in the end, the payoffs are larger.
Exactly.
Is there any transference of this to outdoor growing? Because I know we talked a lot about greenhouses and stuff. What about outdoor nursery growing and things like that? Is there any of this that transfers where you don't have as much control of the environment?
Well, actually, it is not done at the moment, but I'm very convinced that you could use the methods, because it's still a plant and it still has the same, a specific climate around it. The only thing you can't change is the climate itself, but you can, for instance, change plant density. You can use shading, and that's something, for instance, we have done in the south of Spain, where they have no heating in the plastic greenhouses, and they had a lot of problems with fungal diseases. And I told them, don't buy heating systems, because they are expensive, especially in a cheap plastic cover. But why don't you buy a simple, cheap, low-cost screen and cover your plants? As soon as your sky is open, then the plant will lose a lot of energy, radiation energy, to the sky, and it's under glass, under plastic, it's even more than under glass, because the glass is taking away part of the problem. And well, we tried it, and it works. It's a very simple method, and you can do exactly the same in the open field production. And actually, in the Netherlands, many fruit producers, apples, pears, strawberries, all kinds of berries, are using this method now. They don't really understand what they're doing, but okay, they should buy the sensor to really understand why and what's the best time of the year they can do it.
So there is some transference.
There is some transference. A wine grower told me a funny story about how he protects his grapes from freezing. And he said, well, I have a big can, and I have a fire in it, and it produces a lot of smoke. I put water on the wood, so it produces a lot of smoke. And then it creates so much heat that my plants are prevented from freezing, protected from freezing. I said, well, it does work, but it's not what's really happening. The smoke is producing a cloud, and the cloud takes away the radiation of the sky. So you're doing exactly the same.
Yeah. So it's working, but the actual physics behind it is different than what we think is actually happening. Just like you said with introducing the air and the transpiration.
Yeah. And if you would have problems,
Yeah, absolutely. It's been absolutely fascinating just hearing you talk about your journey and how you got there. And I know you just delved a little bit into the technical details. And you said you do have a 380-page book that can be read in a couple days if you're up for it. And is there any other places that a grower could go to look up some of this information? And do you have some of it on websites, some of the empirical evidence, the data, or testimonials?
We have plantempowerment.academy. It's behind my back. That's our website, where you can get a lot of information. If you go to the plantempowerment.com website, you will find all kinds of courses, webinars, etc. I've also worked on those, cooperated on those, and you can find the information there. And there will be coming more soon, so keep an eye on that. And of course, the magazines.
Yeah, and like the magazines, as in you have your own magazines, or in the horticulture magazines, you have...
We don't have our own magazines. The horticulture magazines, yeah. Especially in Canada, they're quite...
Yeah, plantempowerment.academy, plantempowerment.com, and then is the name of the book called Plant Empowerment?
Exactly. Yep.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It was a delight to talk to you, and very interesting to learn that. I'm not a physicist or a mechanical engineer, but I think you brought it down to a level where it was understandable. And if we have any more questions, or possibly look forward to talking about it again in the future and see where this goes.
And you can ask your questions on the website. So there's many ways to get in touch.
Many ways to get in touch.
Wow. It was my pleasure to be here. And I hope
I
didn't scare you too much.
No, it's all good.
Complicated.
I'm here to be curious. So it was interesting to learn about it.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.